sponsors for this event series. Hutch Blackwell, the old WHD, they've been with us from the beginning on this. Thank you, Mike. American Family Insurance, XL Energy, Walmart, ARP Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin Hospital Association. I also want to tell you about our new directory is out. I know you've been waiting for it. It's like the international bestseller just arriving in the bookstore, right? So anyway, here is the new Wis Politics directory and almanac. And Colin Schmies from our office can sell you a copy here. Colin, where are you at? There's Colin right there. And Colin can sell you a copy after the event. So don't leave the event without it. Okay, upcoming events here at the Madison Club. On January 31st, Governor Tommy Thompson, former HHS Secretary, will be here to talk about the many possible changes to the Affordable Care Act and healthcare in general. On February 9th, we have Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald to talk about GOP Senate priorities. Then on March 16th, we have the Democratic Minority Leaders, Senator Schilling and Representative Barker, to talk about Democratic priorities this session. But today, we're going to talk about the Assembly Republicans, and please welcome Speaker Robert Voss. But first, Mr. Speaker has a special announcement about the 100th anniversary of the Capitol, and the celebration is going to kick off on January 30th, right?
Correct.
Okay, tell us about it.
So most of us who have worked in the Capitol sometimes take it for granted that we get to work in not only the single largest tourist attraction in the state, but also one of the most beautiful buildings that really is spectacular. I have had the chance to go around the country, and I tell you that our Capitol is probably not only one of the most prettiest, one of the prettiest outside, but it is also wonderful inside. So most of you probably realize the Capitol was built in 1917. It's the third state capitol. The first one was in Belmont, the second one was on the same grounds but burned down. So we formed a Capitol Commission. I actually put a budget amendment into the last budget to form a Capitol Commission. That was vetoed by Governor Walker. We actually took, I took action on behalf of the legislature, so I created the Capitol Commission. So we now have a set of folks, the Chief Justice is on it, both sides in the Assembly and the Senate, the Governor's office is represented, to really look at 2017 and celebrate the fantastically special place that we know as the state capitol. So we have our kickoff. We have invited all of the former governors of Wisconsin to attend, along with all of the former leaders, majority and minority, in both houses. I just found out there are 65 of them who are still with us, so we hope that a sizable contingent of those folks will be able to come back. During the course of the year, we have lots of really cool things planned. I know that one of the ideas that they have is on July 5th, which of course is my birthday, we are going to be having hopefully a concert on the square which will focus on a patriotic theme with fireworks over the Capitol and really a nice festivity inside. We're going to have some kind of a gala in the fall. We're doing a contest to try to make sure that every teacher statewide has an opportunity to bring their students in either the spring or the fall to the Capitol. To reinvigorate what was a common practice that unfortunately kind of waned during all the protests where many teachers did not bring their students here, so we're trying to reinvigorate that. So lots of wonderful ideas, many of them from people who have served here before, many of them from people who are just experiencing the wonder of walking in that building every day. But it's going to be a really cool year, and hopefully we'll do even more historic things inside that building as opposed to just the last topic.
Okay, well that was nice and short. All right. Okay, so now we're going
to
talk.
Looking for funding, though.
You can't do that here.
I'm just going to say there's a group of former legislators who are helping to raise private sector dollars. So if any of you would like to help, feel free to reach out and let us know how.
Okay, you're not going to get a website URL.
Oh, no, no.
A toll-free number, though, okay? Okay. All right, there's an inauguration on Friday. Surely you've heard. Okay, so, and there's a GOP Congress, dominated Congress. A lot of what happens there could affect you and the Assembly Republicans. So what are your hopes, dreams, fears about what will happen in D.C. and how it will affect what your big majority wants to do?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm excited about the prospect of having change come to Washington. I will tell you, as I look back on the Obama years, there were things that every president does right, and there are things that every president does wrong. I'll only focus on President Obama's farewell address. I didn't watch the entire thing, but there were certain aspects of it that I thought were very poignant and things that we should all think about. And the two points that I thought were the most important, number one, in the democracy, we have to agree on a common set of facts. And then once we have the facts understood, then we can begin to argue about the solution. I think that's a problem that we have not only in Washington, but also in Wisconsin. And the second thing is that a real conversation does not happen online. You have to actually look the person in the eye and actually discuss topics, not just with some anonymous blogger that you've never heard of from somewhere. So as I think about how that impacts us, I think it really impacts our politics in some ways positive and in some ways negative. So I think most of you probably remember Donald Trump was not my choice in the primaries. I was first Senator Marco Rubio. But I look and think about where we are today. I would have never predicted the outcome a year ago. So I am not going to begin to predict what it will look like in a year from now. I told my caucus 2016 was going to be one of the worst election cycles of the decade, and I was wrong. So there's a lot of things that you think you know what you're talking about, but many times the reality around us is just totally different. So what I hope for out of Washington, I hope that state legislators all around the country are finally given the opportunity to be the innovators that Justice Brandeis said we should be, the laboratories of democracy, where if California wants to go far left, and Massachusetts wants to go far left, and Wisconsin wants to go middle of the road, and somebody else is far right, that's what states should be doing. They should be the ones allowed to experiment to figure out which system works best, and then using that as a national model. Take Tommy Thompson. He was the leader in welfare reform because we were allowed to innovate in Wisconsin. Eventually that became President Clinton's signature achievement, and it went on to be dramatically changed by Barack Obama, really without much input from the states. It was kind of a one-size-fits-all Washington, D.C. solution. So my hope is that we go back to that innovative idea to say, Washington doesn't know every solution, and it doesn't certainly know every problem that we face. So I hope on things that are easier, worker training. There is not a constituency in Washington, D.C. where keeping the hundreds of worker training programs that we have that, for the most part, have all kinds of burdensome rules and requirements but don't actually help to employ people or to create jobs back in our states. That would be an easy one that I think they could block grant that I know our legislature would love to be able to get involved in to say, how do we do a better job of training people for the jobs of the future without all the bureaucracy? Medicaid, education funding, all of those things I think are possible. It's why we formed a brand new committee called the Federalism Committee, which is going to have its own budget to go out to Washington, D.C. to lobby on behalf of bringing power back to the states, both Democrats and Republicans. I was just at NCSL, our National Conference of State Legislators, and almost unanimously, both Democrats and Republicans have said that they support the concept of federalism. It's funny how all these Democrats are now converts because of the president that's going to be taking office. But I'll take any convert, however it happens. So federalism means we get the opportunity to make the decision. So I am optimistic that at least for this first year, Washington, D.C. will follow through on giving us more opportunity to have an impact. After that, unfortunately, power tends to go where people have the right to make the decision. So,
okay, you mentioned the block granting, and then the other thing I think that's out there is whether there will be a big infrastructure package, whether that would be direct payments to states and governments or whether that would be through tax credits, I think remains to be seen. But that won't affect this year's budget discussion, but it could seem to affect if you did a budget redo or a budget reset after these things happen. Do you see that the possibility of those of that?
I do. I feel really good about where our Wisconsin economy is. I think our budget is in good shape. I think you're going to see in the relatively near future as the Fiscal Bureau puts out its projections for where we want to be so that the governor uses those numbers to create his budget, that our fiscal situation is actually in a pretty good place. And that's to the credit of the governor and the legislature for holding the line on spending and helping to grow the economy. When I look at the long run, we know that the deadline for enactment of the federal fiscal year is September 30th. Their year begins October 1st. They are less functional than we are, and we always go right up to the deadline. So do I think it's realistic they're going to pass a bunch of bills in the middle of the summer? No. I think it's more realistic that we will have an understanding by the fall, which will mean by the time we come back for the fall floor period, perhaps even the spring, I hope that we will have the ability to reshape how we deal with Medicaid, how we deal with the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA, and along with that, worker training and other options. But that's why it's so important for us to be there over the course of the next 6 months, making sure that we explain to our members of Congress and the Trump administration that we are ready to act if you give us the chance.
So you're going to do a one-year budget then?
No, we're going to do a two-year budget because we don't know that anything's going to happen. But I also am fairly optimistic that a lot of these things will occur. I think there will be a stimulus package in some way. It'll either be the infrastructure bill, tax cuts. I think most economic forecasters are building both of those into their economic models, that there will be some kind of a federal infrastructure bill and some tax cuts. What they'll look like, that's still up in the air. Paul Ryan, who I think we would all agree, whether you like him or not, is incredibly bright and has a plan. I saw this week that President-elect Trump criticized some portions of the House tax bill, so it sounds like it's not like, you know, smooth sailing right in the very beginning, but that's what we'll have to see.
Okay, you mentioned Ryan. I mean, Wisconsin's in a unique position to have two really preeminent power players in position. That this year you're going to have Ryan Priebus in the White House, and you're going to have Paul Ryan as the Speaker again. What does that it mean in tangible terms for Wisconsin? Since what does it really mean for Wisconsin, let alone for federalism?
Well, just because you have the Speaker doesn't always mean that those are the interests that are put first. One of my friends tells me that the same time that I became Speaker was the time period that Governor Walker decided not to do the north-south of the interstate. So it doesn't always mean just because you get the job that you instantly get what you want for your area. So I would say that I think having Paul Ryan at the table as a chief architect is really good for America, because I think he's bright, he's articulate, he has a plan, he's a good communicator. I think the fact that he understands the issues in Wisconsin makes it even more important that he knows our needs. But I understand the job of Speaker, which is to make sure you have buy-in from your entire conference, your entire caucus, while keeping in mind that you have the special needs of your own district, your own state. And I would say Bryant's is in the same place. He is, the job of the Chief of Staff is different, right? He is the one who is tasked with carrying out the wishes of the President. Now, he gets to give his input, and of course, he gets to be the gatekeeper to the President, but ultimately, Donald Trump's going to make the decisions, not Reince. So I think the key player to have Reince at the table is wonderful for us, and I think it's really a great pick by the President, but I think the more important player of the two, in my mind, is really Paul Ryan, to make sure that as we go forward, the bills that are passing, the impact that they have, Wisconsin isn't forgotten, and I know Paul won't let that happen.
Okay, you also mentioned, we talked a little bit about the infrastructure thing, and I'm just wondering, does that, you spend a lot of time here on the transportation issue, even before the budget is introduced, but does the infrastructure, the federal infrastructure potential, does that solve the issue? Could that solve the Wisconsin issue?
No. It doesn't come close. So, when the federal government allocates funding for roads through a six-year transportation bill, that's the traditional norm. So when they pass a trillion-dollar, billion-dollar, $100 billion, whatever it is, Wisconsin traditionally gets about 2% of the funding. That's kind of the historical norm. So if, as an example, somehow they would pass a $1 trillion stimulus bill, that means Wisconsin would get $20 billion if it was the same formula, the same idea, under the federal road funding backs. Well, I think as I listen to President-elect Trump, it's about a lot of things. It's not just about roads, it's about broadband, it's about harbors, it's about airports, it's about infrastructure in all kinds of ways. And I think you also have a GOP Congress that I don't think is all that excited about putting $1 trillion onto our debt. We've had such a massive run-up under President Obama. So let's assume that it's a much smaller number and it's spread out over 6 years. There are important priorities. It could help. But I don't think that is going to solve our $1 billion deficit. Especially, as you had mentioned, Jeff, it's not going to happen in the next near term. There's a lot of negotiations that has to happen before that. So if you think about how the stimulus bill was under the very first acts of the Congress when Barack Obama was in control, they required states to spend money, to draw down money that was brought by the federal government. It wasn't just all federal funding. So no matter what, even if we did that, we are still going to need to have revenues on the state side, even if it was a big slug of cash for broadband, infrastructure, all those kind of things. So I think under almost any scenario, Wisconsin still needs to do its job, no matter what's going to happen to Washington.
Okay, let me touch on another couple quick issues, and then we'll open up to the audience. Okay, so UW funding. The governor mentioned a tuition cut for UW system in his State of the State speech. I would not call the reaction from legislative leaders to be wildly enthusiastic, but it was like, well, that's interesting, we're open to it. But the, you know, UW system is he's asking for a tuition cut, and the UW system is asking for some more money, and then more money for employees to be more competitive in the marketplace. So how do you view the UW system funding, I guess, writ large? Does there have to be, does the economy have to zoom to make it happen? Is there room to make it happen? What's your overall sense for where the UW system request and the governor's request, how that all fits together?
Sure, so let me start by making a basic assumption that when an individual professor, an individual campus, an administrator in the UW system makes a decision that I disagree with, that doesn't mean that somehow the entire system should be chastised or looked down upon because they make one stupid decision. Because as if I had time and I did nothing but look at the UW system, I could find at least a stupid decision a day, right? But that is not my job. Now, some legislators take it as their responsibility to look for every possible way they can to criticize the university system, okay? That is not my job. So I look at the university to say they are probably the single most important economic engine that our state has, period. Okay. But it's true. I mean, there's nothing I can say about it. It's just the absolute truth. So a couple data points that we need to think about. Under Governor Walker's own projections, which I agree with, we need about 100,000 people to fill positions each year for about the next 7 to 8 years. We are graduating 58,000 high school students a year. So we instantly start, if every high school student stays in the state, we are starting at a deficit of 42,000 people. So we have got to find ways to bring more smart people into Wisconsin, attract people to come to our state. If you take and draw a line from Green Bay over to the Minnesota border, that region north of that line is one of the oldest regions in the entire country today, and it's getting worse. We're gonna see that a huge percentage of our population is gonna be over 75. We need more young people to stay here. We need more good paying jobs to attract them. Well, that's not gonna happen simply by having a strategy that doesn't employ having the university be as strong as it can be. So I supported the reductions to the UW funding because we had to as we made our priorities. I think we made good decisions, so I'll stand behind those. Is there waste in the UW system? There certainly is. I think that if I were given the chance to go in there, I could make a lot of different decisions. But I also look and say, I can either become a critic where all I do is talk down the university system, or I can figure out a way to give them the resources to make sure that they are doing what they need for our kids in the future. Do I think that they should have more intellectual diversity so that a student hears from a far left-wing professor and a far right-wing professor? Yes, I do. I think that hurts our competitive nature when we only present one side of the equation in every single topic that there is. Global warming. Some people think it's real, other people are critics. If you're a student on the campus, why shouldn't you hear from both? Well, somehow we have gotten people to believe that you should only hear one half of the equation. So let me go back to what Barack Obama said. You need to actually listen and have a conversation if you want to explain to people why you need to go where you need to go. So the university has to do a better job, in my mind, of explaining how important they are, why they are the job creator, they are the idea creator, and they have become so focused on political correctness and one-size-fits-all solutions to everything, they have lost a lot of support in the legislature. And I have met with time and time again to try to explain to them, you need to do more than just say, give us more money for the same old. That's kind of their song and dance. So Governor Walker's proposing, I think, ideas to have performance enhancements. Okay, I would like to have students graduate in 4 years. I think that's a good goal. I would like them to graduate in careers where they can find a good paying job. That's a great goal. I would like to say, let's make sure that people can hear every perspective on campus. That's a great goal. Do I think a goal should be to cut tuition? That wouldn't be my goal, because I want to have a value proposition. If I could get out in 3.5 years, I would rather pay a little bit more in tuition than staying 4 or 5 years because I can't get the classes. So if we have extra money, while I'm open to the governor's idea and I want to see the exact language, I would rather put the money in financial aid to help students who are going to leave with a lot of debt because they start with no money. Their parents are maybe lower economic means, maybe they're middle class. That's what financial aid is for. So just cutting tuition across the board means that you are going to give the same assistance to somebody who could write a check out without even blinking as you are to somebody who's a first generation college student. So if we have the money to invest, my preference would be financial aid, but I'm open to his suggestion once I see what it actually is.
What about the UW proposal for pay increases?
I support those too. So it all depends on how well our budget is doing. So for me, I look at it and say, I believe our economy is heading in all the right directions. The numbers that I have seen from the administration look like our spending is at a good level, our economy is growing, we have a high labor participation rate, wages are increasing, all of the economic things that you would want to look at a state, we're in a good place other than we need more workers. So in my own factory, we see the effects of competition. Amazon opened up in Kenosha, and at Amazon, you can walk in the door, no questions asked, no drug test, no background check. You are instantly hired and it's $13.50. Okay? Now that is great if you were a worker in southeastern Wisconsin. But if we're trying to recruit prison guards to be able to work inside the prison, and we are paying the same or less than other jobs which have upward mobility, you have the ability to earn a raise, you actually can get productivity bonuses, and all we're saying is, if you come work for the state, there's probably a good chance you'll never get a raise. Well, that's not a real strong recruiting goal. So we have got to do a better job of saying, if you work for the state, you have a reasonable expectation that you should get a raise every once in a while, especially if you're in careers that are in high demand. And frankly, almost every career in state government is at a real problem. If you're a prison guard, I have a person that I know in Sturtevant, my district, where I have a prison. He started working for the correctional facility, and almost every single day that he goes to work, there is a 50% chance that he's going to be on mandatory second shift. Well, working 16 hours a day, multiple days per week, week on week, month on month, I don't know about you, but that's pretty tiring. And not only is it tiring, it's not good for the institution, it's not good for morale. So part of that is, sometimes we're penny wise and pound foolish, where maybe we need to hire more employees so we reduce the overtime. Maybe we need to incentivize people to actually get a raise every once in a while because they're doing a good job and the cost of living is going up. So I think that we have certain fields which are in higher demand. You know, there's probably a higher demand for some faculty members than other. You know, political science, probably a little greater supply than engineering professors. Not that they're both not valuable, but you need to make sure that you give the incentives where they are. So I support those at least as a start. But I think we also need to have the honest conversation that you can't have a good, educated, loyal workforce if you never have the opportunity to earn more money.
Okay, the DNR, there's been a lot of action at the DNR, and some people are thrilled, some people, including ex-secretaries, seem to be alarmed at what's going on. Are you alarmed at what's going on, or do you think the things that are happening and the proposals to split the DNR are good ideas?
Well, change is hard. It's a lot easier to defend the status quo than it is to be a change agent. So I don't know all the details of the proposal. I haven't seen the bill. I haven't heard all the discussion about the rationale for why the DNR should be split. If the goal is to increase services at a time where we can save money and do as good a job protecting the environment, I don't know why anybody would be opposed to that. I don't know the details, so it's hard for me to say it's a great idea or it's a bad idea. I would start out with the notion that we need to make sure that we are doing everything we can to do a very difficult job, which is balancing the right to have the most clean, most pristine environment that we are able, but also growing our economy in a way that we can actually afford. One of the priorities that folks have talked to me about is making sure that, as an example, when a new home is constructed, that there aren't all kinds of rules and regulations which drive up the cost and hurt an awful lot of first-time home buyers. I would say the same thing about a new business. We want to make sure that they do everything right according to the rules, but sometimes the rules and regulations have no basis in reality, or they are good long-term goals, which are incredibly short-term expensive, which hurt our economy. So I think all of those things, we shouldn't always say it's all one way or it's all the other. We have to use our common sense balancing act. So I'll be open to their ideas. I have to see the exact proposal. But if it's just a slash and burn the DNR, I don't think that serves any public purpose.
Okay. There's a lot of people involved in healthcare in the room. So one of the proposals that seems to be coming down the pike is self-insurance. Some of the people in your caucus, including John Nygren, have been outspoken against the idea. Do you think that's coming down the pike, and do you think ultimately the decision is going to be with the legislature on that, or is it? Do you think that it's some pilot project is coming down the pike, or where's that going?
Well, that's a good question. Late last summer, sometime last year, I don't remember exactly when it was, we actually talked to the Fiscal Bureau to see if we could hire an actuary to verify what the savings would be if we went to self-insurance. Because, boy, if there's $100 million in savings, we'd have to take a hard look at it. Now, we have been told that there are no savings. It could be a cost. It could be a big savings. So we were trying to quantify exactly what that is, and the Fiscal Bureau told us there's no proposal to analyze. So it's very difficult for us to know what it would be. I will say I start out as a skeptic. I think that if you look at Wisconsin's insurance markets, by and large, you have a Medicaid population, which is about approximately one out of five people in the state, which are paying below the cost to deliver the care. That means the other 80% of folks are paying higher rates to subsidize those people who are in Medicaid. So if we now take a big subset of people, the state employees and those who are in local governments who buy their insurance through the state, and you take those also out of the marketplace, and to try to discount that in some way, you're now adding even more burden onto the rest of the small and large businesses who pay their insurance costs to cover those increasing demands for healthcare services from the other two groups. So if the goal is just to cost shift so that the state saves money by pushing it out of the private sector, I'm not going to support that. If they can show me in other states that, look, it saves money, it doesn't disrupt the private sector, and there's a big cost savings to taxpayers, well, I'd be a fool not to at least be open to it. But once again, having no detail, no analysis, no actual numbers that I can put down there, just put me down as a skeptic, I guess.
Okay, questions from the audience? Just raise your hands, I'll call you, you can shut it up. Yeah, go ahead.
For years, you and I have been having a discussion about Medicaid expansion, and obviously the game has changed with the latest elections.
So that's what you should say. I was right.
Oh. I was going to say that perhaps that it would be better for Wisconsin to position itself for the block grants and how much money we would receive by maximizing how much we were receiving from the federal government. And I wanted to know if there's been any thought to doing a partial Medicaid expansion to cover the people that the governor's already moved on to Medicaid, or looking at the issue again to go to the full expansion in order to cushion those people if the exchanges disappear. You trust the administration now, which was always your number one argument. So no argument here.
Okay. Well, let's start by saying that I trust the incoming administration. I agree with you that. So this past weekend, I was with legislative leaders from around the country, and one of the folks that I spent a considerable amount of time with is the Senate president in Indiana. So Mike Pence, obviously the vice president, taking a lead role in much of the transition. My understanding is he brought his Medicaid director and the number of people who worked on Indiana's conservative Medicaid expansion, where they actually used much more of a market-based approach. They have real deductibles, they have real co-payments, unlike the proposals that were made here in Wisconsin, where it would have just been to expand government insurance. So if that's the goal, I am definitely open to what they will present, but I am not going to support an expansion right now to add a bunch of people onto the Medicaid rolls without having any idea if Washington's going to keep funding it, and all of a sudden we do a roller coaster where you're on benefits, you're off benefits, you're on benefits. I'm just not going to do that. I also think that it's fair to say I would love the opportunity for us to get a Medicaid block grant so that we in Wisconsin could be the innovators we want to be. We have tried on numerous topics to ask for waiver permission from the Obama administration, with almost all of them being denied. So I'm sure they were well-intentioned bureaucrats in a faraway capital, never having visited Wisconsin, but I trust the people who are here to make those decisions. So you're right, the single largest discussion from my understanding is if they do a block grant, will it be on our current spend? Because Illinois, Minnesota, many states around us all took the Medicaid expansion. So they have a higher block grant if you just took spending today. It sounded to me at this meeting that I was at that many people believe, knowing how Washington works, they're not going to cut anybody who gets anything. It's a lot easier to give people who don't have anything. So my hope is if we did that, we would be a higher base level, so we'd have the opportunity to maybe raise rates for those Medicaid providers, maybe actually innovate in a way that has real market-based tendencies to be in the system, so people have a copayment, a deductible. There's a network they have to be in. They can't just go to an emergency room every day and have it all covered for free by Medicaid. Things like that that have got to change.
Go ahead, Camille.
Jeff often accuses me of giving a speech thinly veiled as a question. So I'm going to get right to the question. Would you please raise my gas taxes so I can help pay for the roads?
Yeah.
Probably not. So the example that I have often used, which I think is still true today, if you are a card player, I have a pair of twos, the governor has a straight, and I have to draw three of a kind to win. Now, it's not impossible, but I wouldn't bet on me. I think if you look at our caucus, I give a lot of credit to our members, because we decided that we weren't going to... Once again, to go back to what Barack Obama said, we have to agree on the facts. And unfortunately, in Wisconsin, we are still arguing about the facts. Let me just tell you a couple things that I want you to take away from here to know that they are absolutely true. We are not going to solve our budget deficit in transportation by eliminating roundabouts. Okay? Let's just make sure you understand that. Because if you look at Facebook, a lot of people think if you just eliminate roundabouts, look at all that waste that you would save. Okay? So on roundabouts, they are cheaper than a four-way intersection that is controlled by a stoplight. They are cheaper. So Governor Walker's own DOT has said, let's expand the use of roundabouts to save money for taxpayers. Okay? So let's just agree on that. Second thing, we are not going to eliminate the $1 billion deficit by eliminating prevailing wage. Okay? That is a part of the savings that I think we should look at. But you're not going to find $1 billion in savings when, on average, a road project is somewhere between 10 and 20% labor. Most of it is materials that are increasing as the price of oil fluctuates. So this is where I have a hard time with a lot of people in the public, even the governor's folks, and some of my own caucus saying, let's just agree that these are basic, basic facts, okay? We're not going to find our way out of this deficit by just savings alone. Now, our plan, I think, is pretty sincere. Save first, look for every possible way, and Governor Walker deserves credit. Let's remember, his DOT, under Mark Gottlieb, has identified over $1 billion in savings that are all part of the baked-in number. So we've already done a huge amount of savings to the credit of really smart people at the DOT. We have an audit that's going to be coming out in January. I am positive there are more ideas, and people keep giving them to me. I think we can find a significant chunk of savings to help deal with the deficit. I think then we should prioritize our projects. I think that the priority should be on where are we growing our economy. If you have a brand new business that's coming in, I know in my own region, if you look at the Milwaukee section where the roads were just redone and the Kenosha section, they are booming. There are businesses moving there all the time. There's lots of economic development. There's a little chunk in the middle that just so happens to be in my district where economic activity is not as intense. Well, that's because the roads haven't been reconstructed, and we still have a lot of needs. There's a huge interstate project, Highway K interchange, where they want to open up a massive new business park. They are wondering what's happening with the road reconstruction because that impacts the ability to bring businesses there. That's my real-world example that I see all the time. So I think, like I say, I give credit to our caucus. We put out the No Easy Answers document to try to get people to agree on the problem, and unfortunately, I am still arguing about roundabouts. So it's hard to get progress until I do that. So I am committed to save first, prioritize our projects, then look at revenues. But I think if you look at that poll that WMC put out, no liberal organization, that half of the state agrees that we've got a revenue problem. And the most politically unpopular is the gas tax. So if half the people are there on the gas tax, that means that a significant chunk are there, because we know that tolling, as my favorite, was already significantly higher than gas taxes in all the polling that we did. So I think most people have agreed we have a problem, then we just have to have courage to actually solve it and not just push it down the road and say somebody else will fix it or wait for Washington or all the other mumbo jumbo.
Okay, let's go over to this side of the room. I'll call on it somebody if you don't raise your hand. Really? It's just over here. Okay. This tape was very active. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, we're the activists. So first off, I want to thank you very much for your comments about the university and compensation to worthy state employees. But my question would be this about domestic policy. So cabinet secretaries, you know, there's been a lot talked about with cabinet secretaries.
In Washington.
In Washington. And I'm wondering if you took three of them and talked about who's really going to make an impact, and maybe the agencies could be HHS, EPA, HUD, labor, education, or DOT. Are there three of those cabinet secretaries that, through their own power of the personality, are going to be able to affect change that we're going to see here in Wisconsin?
That's a good question. I haven't pondered that. I'll have to think about that a little bit. If you read Tommy Thompson's commentary about being a cabinet secretary, I think it's fair to say in all of the discussions that I have seen him say, being a cabinet secretary was not his favorite job.
He was good at it.
He was good at it, I agree. But I think part of the problem is you have a city which has an intense amount of influence on the world, much less the states. Lots of people fighting for what they believe in, and it's very difficult to reach consensus. I have that problem with 63 other people in my own caucus, much less if you look at where Speaker Ryan is, the filibuster rule, Donald Trump bringing a lot of new folks in. I am always excited when new people join government, right? Because whatever your background is, if you're in a union, you're retired, you're a business owner, you're a worker on the factory floor, you have ideas that are unique to the system that aren't already worn down, right? The longer you are in an agency, the longer you work with it, the more you accept the reality that you are in, as opposed to looking and saying, why do we do that? How can we do it differently? How could we achieve the goal in a different way? So I look and say, as an example, DOT. We have a problem with road funding nationwide. We are not going to solve it by borrowing. And I think realistically, in the long run, the gas tax is a dying revenue source as we look at two things that are not changing, electric and or hybrid vehicles, and the fact that we have in Wisconsin today a lower number of 16-year-olds with their driver's license than any time in recent history. Why is that? Because young people don't need their own car because they have you as parental Uber. They don't need to go anywhere. They can have a ride for free. They are used to ride sharing. So I don't think we're going to have the same number of cars on the road. So we're going to have to figure out, not just in Wisconsin, but nationwide, how are we going to pay for our transportation system? So I believe in user fees. I believe user fees are the way that it's politically the best because you are directly associating the revenues with the project. So that's why I favor tolling, where you pay for the road, you use it. You use a transit system, you pay for it. You use any system, you should pay for it. So I hope that they would be more open to those long-term issues than just having a discussion about how do we watch revenues decline. In HHS, I would say the same thing. Healthcare, boy, when I was first elected in 2004, Medicaid was important. I mean, it was Badger Care was expanded. I mean, we did a lot of good things. But we're now at the point where, even in Wisconsin, much less nationwide, most of our revenue, if you look at the long-range projections, will literally go to Medicaid unless we figure out how to control expenses. And that's not by having government dictate one size fits all. It's by innovation. How can we do things differently? Delivering the care smarter, coordinated care, you know, doing a lot of the things that we know have to happen to change society for the better. Well, that's going to happen in the states. It's not going to happen in Washington. So I hope that Dr. Price, as a conservative from Georgia, will look and say not a one-size-fits-all solution should be there. So I'm actually excited. I think we're going to have a lot of people who are not traditional. Betsy DeVos, I just signed a letter supporting her. I want somebody who doesn't come from the education elite to say that they have all the answers. Frankly, that's why I look at the university. If it were up to me, I don't think that a chancellor or a dean necessarily, but a chancellor specifically, should have to be an academic. Why do you have to have been a professor for 30 years or 20 years to be able to rise to be the chancellor of a university? How about if we bring in somebody who's run a really successful business to be a change agent to make that campus deliver a product for its students? So I think we need to think differently about all the people who are in these positions and not just assume that it's only people who've done the same job for a long time that are the best. I like people who are change agents.
What's going on? Where are the planned questions? Over here. Okay, go ahead, sir.
Speaker Buss, excuse me, do you have any concerns that the proposed change elimination and of the Affordable Care Act, and all the proposals that have been independently analyzed show that millions of people in the country will lose health insurance, and I don't know what the figures are for Wisconsin. So people either lose it or they won't be able to afford it. Do you have any concerns about that? And will the state leaders petition the Trump administration and the Congress not to do anything that results in people losing their health insurance or making it more expensive for people to pay for health insurance?
Well, that starts with a couple suppositions, so let me just tell you my take on those. First of all, I think many people, not the same ones, lost their health insurance when Obamacare became part of our reality, right? So we know we were all promised you could keep your health plan. Many people couldn't. We know that the reason that some of these health plans are inexpensive is because other people are paying for them. So it's literally just a different kind of cost shift. So if the goal is that everybody keeps exactly what they want with all their subsidies, well, then change is never going to happen. I mean, we're not going to be able to innovate. So for me, the goal should be that every single American, and for me, I can't worry about people in other states, every single Wisconsinite should have access to fantastic care at a reasonable price. That's what it should be. Now, does that mean the government has to run it? The government has to subsidize it? Not in my world. But, you know, somebody said to me a really interesting comment, and it's something that I think about all the time, that whenever you do a project, you have to ask yourself three questions. Do you want it fast or slow? Do you want high quality or low quality? And should it be expensive or cheap? So those three questions. And you can only have two of the three. But what do we want with healthcare? Easy access, cheap, and high quality. It's very, very difficult to achieve that balance. So we've opted to say we want really high quality and really easy access. Well, then that means it's going to be really expensive. So controlling the cost means, in some ways, we have to either figure out how do we have a reasonable expectation. So the fact that people can walk into an emergency room today with no insurance, no nothing, and the expectation is they're going to get the free care and we'll figure it out later, that's nice for the person who gets to walk in there without insurance. And I understand if you're in a life-threatening situation, you have to do that. But it also means a lot of cost shifting occurs to make that happen. So all of these decisions aren't as simple as let's just keep the status quo, which is why it seems to me they are doing the right thing, which is to set a goal. Wally Konecki, if you remember, it's not the exact same, but in 1991, they passed a bill saying a year and a half from now, we're going to pay for 2/3 of property taxes or schools off the property tax. They didn't have a plan. They didn't have the revenue. They set it out as a long-range goal, and then they worked and actually achieved it. So it seems to me that's a reasonable way to go forward on the repeal and replacement, to be able to say we have a long-range goal so the markets can adjust for that, but also make sure that we have a real plan before it happens.
Jeff, in the past, there have been a few times in which the Department of Transportation budget was submitted later. What do you think about that possibly happening this time based on what the federal government may do with transportation? I mean, I can remember Jim Clouser bringing the budget out for Governor Thompson in March, for example, because of the lack of certainty from what the feds are going to do.
Sure. I would say this, Gary. If I had a realistic expectation that they were going to have a plan by March, that would probably be a good strategy. I don't think they're going to have a plan by March. So I think it's less likely that we're going to even really understand what's happening by the time we pass our budget, hopefully by July 1st. So I've looked at breaking out the transportation budget. I'm not opposed to that. But the reason I would do it is if I think there's a reasonable answer to be able to be found. And, you know, Governor Walker's got his position. And it seems like no matter what the facts are, he's immovable. So I'm trying to figure that out.
I understand that Representative Kuyenga will be playing a role in this. He is an incredible good choice for bringing the parties together. I think that's smart if that's part of what your plan is for the session.
Yep, we have asked Dale to take the lead on working with all interested parties to negotiate, hopefully, a long-term solution for transportation. So, yes, that's my hope.
I'll go for a second one. There's nobody else.
Doesn't bother me.
Okay, good.
Sure.
I guess I'd like to make an observation and put it in the form of a question.
Okay, Camille.
The observation is that in your conversation earlier, you referred to the Obama administration as racking up deficits, mm-hmm. and that's the nomenclature deficit. But when you refer to the budget related to transportation, we call it borrowing. And really, they're both deficits.
They are.
And so I wish that everybody would agree to the fact that they're both deficits, and we ought not to belittle one party or one person if there's some spending going in that direction. Similarly, over the last several years, we're incurring more borrowing in the transportation budget, and we should be honest and call that a deficit too.
Yeah, but let me tell you at least the way I see the difference. So in the DOT budget, we are taking a road that lasts 25 years, and we are borrowing so that a future generation helps to pay for a road which they are not even born yet. So I think you can make a reasonable case that a level of borrowing, just like when you buy a house, you don't borrow it all in 1 year. I think that
makes
sense.
I think that's all fine to borrow. Yeah. We just ought to be honest that there's still a deficit occurring.
But here's the difference, though. At the federal level, we are not borrowing for 30-year roads. We are borrowing for today's welfare payments. I mean, that is not wise. We don't do that in Wisconsin. We pay cash for everything. The only thing that, under our Constitution, the only thing we're allowed to borrow for are infrastructure projects, which have a longer-term life. Many times we try it on the bottom. So we're constitutionally prohibited from doing that. I think that's the problem with Washington, frankly, is that they can borrow to increase spending or to decrease taxes. That would not be what I view as responsible. And unfortunately, under President Obama, it's dramatically increased. So that's why I said that.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, so I'm going to bring it, take it from here. Let me just ask a purely political question, but you know, it did involve a bill in the legislature at one time. Okay, so redistricting. There's a redistricting lawsuit that the opponents of the GOP redistricting plan got some traction on, and it's in federal court, but the appeals are likely underway. But you guys, like you said, you thought this was going to be a terrible cycle. You're at 64. I don't know if this state's probably hasn't been this Republican since the 50s. And even if Democrats got their wish and the redistricting plan was the way they wanted it, would they be making up that many seats? And so I guess, or if you got your wish, how could you make it even better?
Oh, don't give me.
don't challenge you on that.
Don't challenge.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, but you know, I mean, it's like you're at 64 under your map. Mm-hmm. But you know, even if they had their map, I don't know, would they be in the majority?
So, the basic concept that George Soros is funding is paying for is that we need to look at the past election results and draw districts based on the outcome. So under our current constitution, you count up the people, you try to respect the fact that we have municipal boundaries, you take into account that we have racial minorities who have been disenfranchised in the past. All of those things go into the constitutional plan, which is why they sued and we won. Okay, we already won. So now they are saying, well, those criteria weren't enough. We want to add another one. So they want to go back and all of the votes who were cast for the assembly in 2012 and say if 50% of those were cast for a Democrat and 50% were cast for a Republican, we're going to draw a map that gives 50% of the seats to the Democrats. That basically, their basic assumption is candidates don't matter, campaigns don't matter, incumbency doesn't matter, how good the issues are or the environment doesn't matter. It should just be the previous election. Well, that is preposterous. Because in effect then, you would have to draw the districts every 2 years. So under our current maps, we have 18 people who are sitting in seats that are 52% or less Republican. There is only one Democrat in a seat that is more than 46% Democrat. Everybody else is 46 or below. So we own seats, except for Steve Doyle's, that are overwhelmingly competitive. So we have a better job. Jenny Toftness is awesome. We have a better team. We have better candidates. We have better recruiting. We have a better message. That's why we win elections. So I guess if you don't like that, you try to say, what's a new set of facts that we can put into the equation that will help us offset the fact that we stink at running campaigns?
Okay, but if you lose in court, would that put a significant dent in your success? If they get their wish and it goes to the Supreme Court and Justice Kennedy gets to buy this theory that you're talking about, well, then, you know, what's the ultimate effect on your majority?
We're not going to lose.
You're not going to lose in court.
We're not going to lose in court. I mean, there is no way that you were going to take hundreds of years of precedent, which is one person, one vote, candidates matter, campaigns matter, and transfer it all into an Excel spreadsheet, where all we're going to do is run the numbers and then draw the districts based on that, taking the voters entirely out of it, except for the ones who voted the last time. So the current election will only be about the past. It's just not going to happen. If it would, I can't even imagine it, because it would upend everything in a negative way, because you would now have people who are obsessed with recruiting a candidate in every race just to run up the numbers, not even running a campaign about the issues. It's just about running up the vote totals. If you think it is partisan now, imagine when the only criteria for drawing districts is how many of your own people you turn out. Not about appealing to anybody else, but just increasing your own vote total. You will see partisanship in a way that is incredibly corrosive, which is why the Supreme Court can never let it happen.
Okay, so that brings us to the close. I want to thank our sponsors for this and the event series here at the Madison Club: Hush Blackwell, XL Energy, ARP Wisconsin, Wisconsin Hospital Association, Walmart, and American Family Insurance. And don't forget your directories. See Colin Schmies, and thank you, Speaker Robin Voss.
Thank you.